and then blossomed into the attribute he'd come to associate with a warrior of the Sioux Nation. His 5 feet 8 inches of height supported fully 200 pounds of lean, hard muscle. His upper arms were the size of some men's upper legs. He had the waist of a ballerina and the shoulders of an NFL linebacker. He was also slightly mad, but Marvin Russell did not know that. Life had not given him or his brother much of a chance. Their father had been an alcoholic who had worked occasionally, and not well, as an auto mechanic, to provide money that he had transferred regularly and immediately to the nearest package store. Marvin's memories of childhood were bitter ones. Shame for his father's nearly perpetual state of inebriation, and shame greater still for what his mother did while her husband was passed out drunk in the living room. Food came from the government dole after the family had returned from Minnesota to the reservation. Schooling came from teachers who despaired of accomplishing anything. His neighborhood had been a scattered collection of government-built plain block houses that stood like specters in perpetual clouds of blowing prairie dust. Neither Russell boy had ever owned a baseball glove. Neither had known a Christmas as much other than a week or two when school was closed. Both had grown in a vacuum of neglect and learned to fend for themselves at an early age. At first, this had been a good thing, for self-reliance was the way of their people. But all children need direction, and direction was something the Russell parents had been unable to provide. The boys had learned to shoot and hunt before they'd learned to read. Often the dinner had been something brought home with .22 caliber holes in it. Almost as often they had cooked the meals. Though not the only poor and neglected youth of their settlement, they had without doubt been at the bottom. And while some of the local kids had overcome their backgrounds, the leap from poverty to adequacy had been far too broad for them. From the time they had begun to drive, well before the legal age, they'd taken their father's dilapidated pickup 100 miles or more on clear, cool nights to distant towns where they might obtain some of the things their parents had been unable to provide. Surprisingly, the first time they'd been caught by another Sioux holding a shotgun, they'd taken their whipping manfully and been sent home with bruises and a lecture. They'd learned from that. From that moment on, they'd only robbed whites. In due course, they'd been caught at that also, red-handed inside a country store by a tribal police officer. It was their misfortune that any crime committed on federal property was a federal case, and further that the new district court judge was a man with more compassion than perception. A hard lesson at that point might or might not have changed their path, but instead they'd gotten an administrative dismissal and counseling. A very serious young lady with a degree from the University of Wisconsin had explained to them over months that they could never have a beneficial self-image if they lived by stealing the goods of others. They would have more personal pride if they found something worthwhile to do. Emerging from that session wondering how the Sioux Nation had ever allowed itself to be overrun by white idiots, they learned to plan their crimes more carefully. But not carefully enough, since the counselor could not have offered them the graduate school expertise that the Russell boys might have received in a proper prison. And so they were caught again a year later, but this time off the reservation, and this time they found themselves dispatched to a year and a half of hard time, because they'd been burglarizing a gun shop. Prison had been the most frightening experience of their lives. Accustomed to land as open and vast as the western sky, they'd spent over a year of their lives in a cage smaller than the federal government deemed appropriate for a badger in a zoo, and surrounded by people far worse than their most inflated ideas of their own toughness. Their first night on the blocks, they'd learned from screams that rape was not a crime inflicted exclusively on women. Needing protection, they had almost immediately been swept into the protective arms of their fellow Native American prisoners of the American Indian Movement. They had never given much thought to their ancestry. Subliminally, they might have sensed that their peer group did not display the qualities they had seen on those occasions when the family TV had worked, and probably felt some vague shame that they had always been different. They'd learned to snicker at Western movies, of course, whose Indian actors were most often whites or Mexicans, mouthing words that reflected the thoughts of Hollywood scriptwriters who had about as much knowledge of the West as they had of Antarctica. But even there the messages had left a negative image of what they were and from what roots they had come. The American Indian movement had changed all that. Everything was the white man's fault. Espousing ideas that were a mix of trendy East Coast anthropology, a dash of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, more than a little John Ford Western, what else, after all, was the American cultural record, and a great deal of misunderstood history, the Russell brothers came to understand that their ancestors were of noble stock, ideal hunter-warriors who had lived in harmony with nature and the gods. The fact that the Native Americans had lived in as peaceful a state as the Europeans. The word Sioux in Indian dialect means snake, and was not an appellation assigned with affection. And that they had only begun roaming the Great Plains in the last decade of the 18th century were somehow left out, along with the vicious intertribal wars. Times had once been far better. They had been masters of their land, following the buffalo, hunting, living a healthy and satisfying life under the stars, and, occasionally, fighting short, heroic contests among themselves, rather like medieval jousts. Even the torture of captives was explained as an opportunity for warriors to display their stoic courage to their admiring, if sadistic, murderers. Every man craves nobility of spirit, and it wasn't Marvin Russell's fault that the first such opportunity came from convicted felons. He and his brother learned about the gods of earth and sky, beliefs in which had been cruelly suppressed by false white beliefs. They learned about the Brotherhood of the Plains, about how the whites had stolen what was rightfully theirs, had killed the buffalo which had been their livelihood, had divided, compressed, massacred, and finally imprisoned their people, leaving them little beyond alcoholism and despair. As with all successful lies, the cachet to this one was a large measure of truth. Marvin Russell greeted the first orange limb of the sun, chanting something that might or might not have been authentic. No one really knew anymore, least of all him. But prison had not been an entirely negative experience. He'd arrived with a third-grade reading level and left with high school equivalency. Marvin Russell had not ever been a dullard, and it was not his fault either that he'd been betrayed by a public school system that had consigned him to failure before birth. He read books regularly, everything he could get on the history of his people. Not quite everything. He was highly selective in the editorial slant of the books he picked up. Anything in the least unfavorable to his people, of course, reflected the prejudice of whites. The Sioux had not been drunks before the whites arrived, had not lived in squalid little villages, had certainly not abused their children. That was all the invention of the white man. But how to change things? He asked the sun. The glowing ball of gas was red with yet more blowing dust from this hot, dry summer, and the image that came to Marvin was of his brother's face. The stop-motion freeze frame of the TV news. The local station had done things with the tape that the network had not. Every frame of the incident had been examined separately. The bullet striking John's face, two frames of his brother's face detaching itself from the head. Then the ghastly aftermath of the bullet's passage. The gunshot. Damn that nigger and his vest, and the hands coming up like something in a Roger Corman movie. He'd watched it 5 times, and each pixel of each image was so firmly fixed in his memory that he knew he'd never be able to forget it. Just one more dead Indian. Yes, I saw some good Indians. General William Tecumseh, a Native American name, Sherman had once said. They were dead. John Russell was dead, killed like so many without the chance for honorable combat, shot down like the animal a Native American was to whites. But more brutally than most. Marvin was sure the shot had been arranged with care. Cameras rolling. That wimp pussy reporter with her high-fashion clothes. She'd needed a lesson in what was what, and those FBI assassins had decided to give it to her. Just like the cavalry of old at Sand Creek and Wounded Knee and 100 other nameless, forgotten battlefields. And so Marvin Russell faced the sun, one of the gods of his people, and searched for answers. The answer wasn't here, the sun told him. His comrades were not reliable. John had died learning that, trying to raise money with drugs, using drugs. As though the whiskey the white man had used to destroy his people wasn't bad enough. The other warriors were creatures of their white-made environment. They didn't know that they'd already been destroyed by it. They called themselves Sioux warriors, but they were drunkards, petty criminals who had labored and failed to succeed even in that undemanding field. In a rare flash of honesty, how could one be dishonest before one of his gods? Marvin admitted to himself that they were less than he, as his brother had been. Stupid to join their foolish quest for drug money. And ineffective. What had they ever accomplished? They'd killed an FBI agent and a United States marshal, but that was long in the past. Since then? Since then they had merely talked about their one shining moment. But what sort of moment had it been? What had they accomplished? Nothing. The reservation was still there. The liquor was still there. The hopelessness was still there. Had anyone even noticed who they were and what they did? No. All they had accomplished was to anger the forces that continued to oppress them. So now the warrior society was hunted, even on its own reservation, living not like warriors at all, but like hunted animals. But they were supposed to be the hunters, the son told him, not the prey. Marvin was stirred by the thought. He was supposed to be the hunter. The whites were supposed to fear him. It had once been so, but was no more. He was supposed to be the wolf in the fold, but the white sheep had grown so strong that they didn't know there was such a thing as a wolf, and they hid behind formidable dogs who were not content to stay with the flocks, but hunted the wolves themselves until they, and not the sheep, were frightened, driven, nervous creatures, prisoners on their own range. So, he had to leave his range. He had to find his brother wolves. He had to find wolves for whom the hunt was still real. Chapter 3, A Single Sit. This was the day. His day. Captain Benjamin Zadine had enjoyed rapid career growth in the Israeli National Police. The youngest captain on the force, he was the last of three sons, the father of two sons of his own, David and Mordecai, and until very recently had been on the brink of suicide. The death of his beloved mother and the departure of his beautiful but adulterous wife had come within a single week, and that had only been 2 months before. Despite having done everything he'd ever planned on doing, he'd suddenly been faced with a life that seemed empty and pointless. His rank and pay, the respect of his subordinates, his demonstrated intelligence and clear-headedness in times of crisis and tension, his military record on dangerous and difficult border patrol duty, they were all as nothing compared to an empty house of perverse memories. Though Israel is regarded most often as the Jewish state, that name disguises the fact that only a fraction of the country's population is actively religious. Beni Zadine had never been so, despite the entreaties of his mother. Rather, he'd enjoyed the swinging lifestyle of a modern hedonist, and not seen the inside of a shul since his bar mitzvah. He spoke and read Hebrew because he had to. It was the national language. But the rules of his heritage were to him a curious anachronism, a backward aspect of life in what was otherwise the most modern of countries. His wife had only accentuated that. One might measure the religious fervor of Israel, he'd often joked, by the swimming suits on its many beaches. His wife's background was Norwegian. A tall, skinny blonde, Elin Zadine looked about as Jewish as Eva Braun. That was their joke on the matter, and still enjoyed showing off her figure with the skimpiest of bikinis, and sometimes only half of that. Their marriage had been passionate and fiery. He'd known that she'd always had a wandering eye, of course, and had occasionally dallied himself, but her abrupt departure to another had surprised him. More than that, the manner of it had left him too stunned to weep or beg, had merely left him alone in a home that also contained several loaded weapons, whose use, he knew, might easily have ended his pain. Only his sons had stopped that. He could not betray them as he'd been betrayed. He was too much of a man for that. But the pain had been, still was, very real. Israel is too small a country for secrets. It was immediately noticed that Elon had taken up with another man, and the word had quickly made its way to Benny's station, where men could see from the hollow look around the eyes that their commander's spirit had been crushed. Some wondered how and when he would bounce back, but after a week the question had changed to whether he would do so at all. At that point, one of Zadine's squad sergeants had taken matters in hand. Appearing at his captain's front door on a Thursday evening, he'd brought with him Rabbi Israel Cohn. On that evening, Benjamin Zadine had rediscovered God. More than that, he told himself, surveying the Street of the Chain in Old Jerusalem, he knew again what it was to be a Jew. What had happened to him was God's punishment, no more, no less. Punishment for ignoring the words of his mother, punishment for his adultery, for the wild parties with his wife and others, for 20 years of evil thoughts and deeds while pretending to be a brave and upstanding commander of police and soldiers. But today he would change all that. Today he would break the law of man to expiate his sins against the word of God. It was early in the morning of what promised to be a blistering day, with a dry easterly wind blowing in from Arabia. He had 40 men arrayed behind him, all of them armed with a mixture of automatic rifles, gas guns, and other arms that fired rubber bullets, more accurately called missiles, made of ductile plastic that could knock a grown man down, and if the marksmen were very careful, stop a heart from blunt trauma. His police were needed to allow the law to be broken, which was not the idea that Captain Zadine's immediate superiors had in mind, and to stop the interference of others willing to break a higher law to keep him from his job. That was the argument Rabbi Cohn had used, after all. Whose law was it? It was a question of metaphysics, something far too complicated for a simple police officer. What was far simpler, as the rabbi had explained, was the idea that the site of Solomon's temple was the spiritual home of Judaism and the Jews. The site on Temple Mount had been chosen by God, and if men had disputed that fact, it was of little account. It was time for Jews to reclaim what God had given them. A group of 10 conservative and Hasidic rabbis would today stake out the place where the new temple would be reconstructed in precise accordance with the Holy Scriptures. Captain Zadine had orders to prevent their march through the chain gate, to stop them from doing their work, but he would ignore those orders, and his men would do as he commanded, protecting them from the Arabs who might be waiting with much the same intentions as he was supposed to have. He was surprised that the Arabs were there so early. No better than animals, really, the people who'd killed David and Mati. His parents had told all of their sons what it had been like to be a Jew in Palestine in the 1930s. The attacks, the terror, the envy, the open hatred. How the British had refused to protect those who had fought with them in North Africa, against those who had allied themselves with the Nazis. The Jews could depend on no one but themselves and their God, and keeping faith with their God meant reestablishing his temple on the rock where Abraham had forged the covenant between his people and their Lord. The government either didn't understand that, or was willing to play politics with the destiny of the only country in the world where Jews were truly safe. His duty as a Jew superseded that, even if he'd not known it until quite recently. Rabbi Cohn showed up at the appointed time. Alongside him was Rabbi Eleazar Goldmark, a tattooed survivor of Auschwitz, where he had learned the importance of faith while in the face of death itself. Both men held a bundle of stakes and surveyor's string. They'd make their measurements, and from this day forward a relay of men would guard the site, eventually forcing the government of Israel to clear the site of Muslim obscenities. An upwell of popular support throughout the country and a flood of money from Europe and America would allow the project to be completed in 5 years. And then no one would ever be able to talk about taking this land away from those to whom God himself had deeded it.
"Shit," muttered someone behind Captain Zadine, but a turn and a look from his commander stifled whoever had blasphemed the moment of destiny. Benny nodded to the 2 leading rabbis who marched off. The police followed their captain, 50 meters behind. Zadine prayed for the safety of Cone and Goldmark, but knew that the danger they faced was fully accepted, as Abraham had accepted the death of his son as a condition of God's law. But the faith that had brought Zadine to this moment had blinded him to what should have been the obvious fact that Israel was indeed a country too small for secrets, and that fellow Jews who viewed Cone and Goldmark as simply another version of Iran's fundamentalist Ayatollahs knew of what was happening, and that as a result, the word had gotten out. TV crews were assembled in the square at the foot of the Wailing Wall. Some wore the hard hats of construction workers in anticipation of the rain of stones that surely was coming. Perhaps that was all the better, Captain Zadine thought as he followed the rabbis to the top of Temple Mount. The world should know what was happening. Unconsciously, he increased his pace to close on Cone and Goldmark. Though they might accept the idea of martyrdom, his job was to protect them. His right hand went down to the holster at his hip and made sure the flap wasn't too tight. He might need that pistol soon. The Arabs were there. It was a disappointment that there were so many, like fleas, like rats in a place they didn't belong. Just so long as they kept out of the way. They wouldn't, of course, and Zadine knew it. They were opposed to the will of God. That was their misfortune. Zadine's radio squawked, but he ignored it. It would just be his commander, asking him what the hell he was up to and ordering him to desist. Not today. Cone and Goldmark strode fearlessly to the Arabs blocking their path. Zadine nearly wept at their courage and their faith, wondering how the Lord would show his favor to them, hoping that they would be allowed to live. Behind him, about half his men were truly with him, which was possible because Benny had worked his watch build to make it so. He knew without looking that they were not using their Lexan shields. Instead, safety switches on their shoulder weapons were now being flicked to the off position. It was hard waiting for it, hard to anticipate the first cloud of stones that would be coming at any moment. Dear God, please let them live. Please protect them. Spare them as you spared Isaac. Zadine was now less than 50 meters behind the two courageous rabbis, one Polish-born, a survivor of the infamous camps where his wife and child had died, where he had somehow kept his spirit and learned the importance of faith, the other American-born, a man who'd come to Israel, fought in her wars, and only then turned to God, as Benny himself had done so brief a span of days before. The two were barely 10 meters from the surly, dirty Arabs when it happened. The Arabs were the only ones who could see that their faces were serene, that they truly welcomed whatever the morning might hold for them, and only the Arabs saw the shock and the puzzlement on the face of the Pole, and the stunned pain on the Americans at the realization of what fate had in mind. On command, the leading row of Arabs, all of them teenagers with a lengthy history of confrontation, sat down. The 100 young men behind them did the same. Then the front row started clapping and singing. Benny took a moment to comprehend it, though he was as fluent in Arabic as any Palestinian. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. The TV crews were immediately behind the police. Several of them laughed in surprise at the savage irony of it. One of them was CNN correspondent Pete Franks, who summed it up for everyone. Son of a bitch! And in that moment, Franks knew that the world had changed yet again. He'd been in Moscow for the first democratic meeting of the Supreme Soviet, in Managua the night the Sandinistas had lost their sure thing election, and in Beijing to see the goddess of liberty destroyed. And now this, he thought. The Arabs finally wised up. Holy shit. I hope you have that tape rolling, Mickey. Are they singing what I think they're singing? Sure as hell sounds like it. Let's get closer. The leader of the Arabs was a 20-year-old sociology student named Hashimi Musa. His arm was permanently scarred from an Israeli club, and half his teeth were gone from a rubber bullet whose shooter had been especially angry on one particular day. No one questioned his courage. He'd had to prove that beyond doubt. He'd had to face death a dozen times before his position of leadership had been assured. But now he had it, and people listened to him, and he was able to activate an idea he'd cherished for 5 endless, patient years. It had taken 3 days to persuade them. Then the fantastic good luck of a Jewish friend disgusted with the religious conservatives of his country who'd spoken a little too loudly about the plans of this day. Perhaps it was destiny, Hashimi thought, or the will of Allah, or simply luck. Whatever it was, this was the moment he'd lived for since his 15th year, when he'd learned of Gandhi and King, and how they had defeated force with naked, passive courage. Persuading his people had meant stepping back from a warrior code that seemed part of their genes, but he'd done it. Now his beliefs would be put to the test. All Beni Zadin saw was that his path was blocked. Rabbi Cohn said something to Rabbi Goldmark, but neither turned back to where the police were stopped, because to turn away was to admit defeat. Whether they were too shocked at what they saw or too angry, he would never learn. Captain Zadin turned to his men. Gas! He'd planned this part in advance. The 4 men with gas guns were all religious men. They leveled their weapons and fired simultaneously into the crowd. The gas projectiles were dangerous, and it was remarkable that no one was injured by them. In a few seconds, gray clouds of tear gas bloomed within the mass of sitting Arabs. But on command, each of them donned a mask to protect himself from it. This impeded their singing, but not their clapping or resolution, and it only enraged Captain Zadin further when the easterly wind blew the gas toward his men and away from the Arabs. Next, men with insulated gloves lifted the hot projectiles and threw them back toward the police. In a minute, they were able to remove their masks, and there was laughter in their singing now. Next, Zadin ordered the rubber bullets launched. He had 6 men armed with these weapons, and from a range of 50 meters they could force any man to run for cover. The first volley was perfect, hitting 6 of the Arabs in the front line. 2 cried out in pain. 1 collapsed, but not 1 man moved from his place except to succor the injured. The next volley was aimed at heads, not chests, and Zadin had the satisfaction of seeing a face explode in a puff of red. The leader, Zadin recognized the face from earlier encounters, stood and gave a command the Israeli captain could not hear, but its significance became clear immediately. The singing became louder. Another volley of rubber bullets followed. One of his marksmen was very angry, the police commander saw. The Arab who'd taken one fully in the face now took another in the top of his head, and with it his body went limp in death. It should have warned Benny that he had already lost control of his men, but worse still was that he was losing control of himself. Hashimi did not see the death of his comrade. The passion of the moment was overwhelming. The consternation on the faces of the 2 invading rabbis was manifest. He could not see the faces of the police behind their masks, but their actions, their movements, made their feelings clear. In a brilliant moment of clarity, he knew that he was winning, and he shouted again to his people to redouble their efforts. This they did, in the face of fire and death. Captain Benjamin Zadin stripped off his helmet and walked forcefully toward the Arabs, past the rabbis who had suddenly been struck with incomprehensible indecision. Would the will of God be upset by the discordant singing of some dirty savages? Uh-oh, Pete Franks observed, his eyes streaming from the gas that had blown over his face. I got it, the cameraman said without bidding, zooming his lens in on the advancing Israeli police commander. Something is going to happen. This guy looks pissed, Pete. Oh, God, Franks thought. Himself a Jew, himself strangely at home in this barren but beloved land, he knew that history was occurring before his eyes yet again, was already composing his 2 or 3 minutes of verbal reporting that would overlay the tape his cameraman was recording for posterity, and was wondering if another Peabody might be in his future for doing his tough and dangerous job supremely well. It happened quickly, much too quickly, as the captain strode directly to the Arab leader. Hashimi now knew that a friend was dead, his skull caved in by what was supposed to be a non-lethal weapon. He prayed silently for the soul of his comrade, and hoped that Allah would understand the courage required to face death in this way. He would. Hashimi was sure of that. The Israeli approaching him was a face known to him. Zadin, the name was. A man who'd been there before often enough. Just one more Israeli face most often hidden behind a Lexan mask and drawn gun. One more man unable to see Arabs as people, to whom a Muslim was the launcher for a rock or a Molotov cocktail. Well, today he'd learn different, Hashimi told himself. Today he'd see a man of courage and conviction. Beni Zadin saw an animal, like a stubborn mule, like... what? He wasn't sure what he saw, but it wasn't a man, wasn't an Israeli. They'd changed tactics, that was all, and the tactics were womanly. They thought this would stand in the way of his purpose? Just as his wife had told him that she was leaving for the bed of a better man, that he could have the children, that his threats to beat her were empty words, that he couldn't do that, wasn't man enough to take charge of his own household. He saw that beautiful empty face and wondered why he hadn't taught her a lesson. She'd just stood there, not a meter away, staring at him, smiling, finally laughing at his inability to do what his manhood had commanded him to do. And so, passive weakness had defeated strength. But not this time. Move, Zadin commanded in Arabic. No. I will kill you. You will not pass. Benny! A level-headed member of the police screamed. But it was too late for that. For Benjamin Zadin, the deaths of his brothers at Arab hands, the way his wife had left, and the way these people just sat in his way was too much. In one smooth motion, he drew his service automatic and shot Hashimi in the forehead. The Arab youth fell forward, and the singing and clapping stopped. One of the other demonstrators started to move, but two others grabbed him and held him fast. Others began praying for their two dead comrades. Zadin turned his gun hand to one of these, but though his finger pressed on the trigger, something stopped him, a gram short of the release pressure. It was the look in the eyes, the courage there, something other than defiance. Resolution, perhaps? And pity, for the look on Zadin's face was anguish that transcended pain, and the horror of what he had done crashed through his consciousness. He had broken faith with himself. He had killed in cold blood. He had taken the life of someone who had threatened no man's life. He had murdered. Zadin turned to the rabbis, looking for something. He knew not what, and whatever he sought simply was not there. As he turned away, the singing began again. Sergeant Moshe Levin came forward and took the captain's weapon. Come on, Benny. Let's get you away from this place.
What have I done?
It is done, Benny. Come with me. Levin started to lead his commander away, but he had to turn and look at the morning's handiwork. Hashimi's body was slumped over, a pool of blood coursing down between the cobblestones. The sergeant knew that he had to do or say something. It wasn't supposed to be like this. His mouth hung open, and his face swung from side to side. In that moment, Hashimi's disciples knew that their leader had won. Ryan's phone rang at 2:03 Eastern Daylight Time. He managed to get it before the start of the second ring.
Yeah.
This is Saunders at the Op Center. Get your TV on. In 4 minutes, CNN is running something hot.
Tell me about it.
Ryan's hand fumbled for the remote controller and switched the bedroom TV on. You ain't gonna believe it, sir. We copied it off the CNN satellite feed, and Atlanta is fast-tracking it onto the network. I don't know how it got past Israeli censors. Anyway,
okay, here it comes.
Ryan rubbed his eyes clear just in time. He had the TV sound muted to keep from disturbing his wife. The commentary was unnecessary in any case.
Dear God in heaven.
That about covers it, sir, the senior watch officer agreed.
Send my driver out now. Call the director. Tell him to get in fast. Get hold of the duty officers at the White House Signals Office. He'll alert the people on his end. We need the DDI and the desks for Israel, Jordan. Hell, that whole area, all the desks. Make sure State's up to speed.
They have their own...
I know that. Call them anyway. Never assume anything in this business, okay?
Yes, sir. Anything else?
Yeah. Send me about 4 hours more sleep.
Ryan set the phone down.
Jack, was that?
Kathy was sitting up. She'd just caught the replay. It sure was, babe.
What's it mean?
It means the Arabs just figured out how to destroy Israel. Unless we can save the place. 90 minutes later, Ryan turned on the West Bend drip machine behind his desk before running over the notes from the night duty staff. It would be a day for coffee. He'd shaved in the car on the way in, and a look at the mirror showed that he'd not done a very good job of it. Jack waited until he had a full cup before marching into the director's office. Charles Alden was there with Cabot. Good morning, the National Security Advisor said.
Yeah,
the deputy director replied in a husky voice.
What do you suppose is good about it?
The president know yet?
No. I didn't want to disturb him until we know something. I'll talk to him when he wakes up.
Six-ish.
Marcus, what do you think of your Israeli friends now?
Have we developed anything else, Jack?
Director Cabot asked his subordinate. The shooter is a police captain, according to the insignia. No name on him yet, no background. The Israelis have him in the jug somewhere, and they're not saying anything. From the tape, it looks like 2 definitely dead, probably a few more with minor injuries. Chief of Station has nothing he can report to us except that it really happened, and we have that on tape. Nobody seems to know where the TV crew is. We did not have any assets at the site when all this happened, so we're going exclusively from the news coverage.
Again, Ryan didn't add. The morning was bad enough. Temple Mount is shut down, guarded by their army now. Nobody in or out, and they've closed access to the Wailing Wall also.
That may be a first.
Our embassy over there has not said anything. They're waiting for instructions from here. Same story for the others. No official reaction from Europe yet, but I expect that to change within the hour. They're at work already, and they got the same pictures from their Sky News service.
It's almost 4, Alden said, wearily checking his watch. In 3 hours, people are going to have their breakfasts upset. What a hell of a thing to see in the morning.
Gentlemen, I think this one's going to be big.
Ryan, you called it. I remember what you said last month.
Sooner or later the Arabs had to wise up, Jack said.
Alden nodded agreement.
It was gracious of him, Jack noted. He'd said the same thing in one of his books several years earlier.
I think Israel can weather this. They always have.
Jack cut his director off.
No way, boss, Ryan said.
Someone had to straighten Cabot out.
It's what Napoleon said about the moral and the physical. Israel depends absolutely on having the moral high ground. Their whole cachet is that they are the only democracy in the region, that they are the guys in white hats. That concept died about 3 hours ago. Now they look like Bulb, whoever it was, in Selma, Alabama, except he used water hoses. The civil rights community is going to go berserk.
Jack paused to sip at his coffee.
It's a simple question of justice. When the Arabs were throwing rocks and cocktails, the police could say that they were using force in response to force. Not this time. Both the debtors were sitting down and not threatening anybody.
It's the isolated act of one deranged man, Cabot announced angrily.
Not so, sir. The one shot with a pistol was like you say, but the first victim was killed with 2 of those rubber bullets at a range of more than 20 yards, with 2 aimed shots from a single shot weapon. That's cold, and it wasn't any accident.
Are we sure he's dead? Alden asked.
My wife's a doc, and he looked dead to her. The body spasmed and went limp, probably indicating death from massive head trauma. They can't say this guy tripped and fell onto the curb. This really changes things. If the Palestinians are smart, they'll double down their bets. They'll stay with this tactic and wait for the world to respond. If they do that, they can't lose, Jack concluded.
I agree with Ryan, Alden said. There'll be a UN resolution before dinner. We'll have to go along with it.
and that just might show the Arabs that non-violence is a better weapon than rocks are. What will the Israelis say? How will they react?
Alden knew what the answer was. This was to enlighten the DCI, so Ryan took the question.
First, they'll stonewall. They're probably kicking themselves for not intercepting the tape, but it's a little late for that. This was almost certainly an unplanned incident. I mean that the Israeli government is as surprised as we are, otherwise they would have grabbed the TV crew. That police captain is having his brain picked apart now. By lunchtime, they'll say that he's crazy. Hell, he probably is, and that this is an isolated act. How they do their damage control is predictable, but...
It's not going to work, Alden interrupted. The president's going to have a statement out by 9. We can't call this a tragic incident. It's cold-blooded murder of an unarmed demonstrator by a state official.
Look, Charlie, this is just an isolated incident, Director Cabot said again.
Maybe so, but I've been predicting this for 5 years. The National Security Advisor stood and walked to the windows. Marcus, the only thing that has held Israel together for the past 30 years has been the stupidity of the Arabs. Either they never recognized that Israeli legitimacy is based entirely on their moral position, or they just didn't have the wit to care about it. Israel is now faced with an impossible ethical contradiction. If they really are a democracy that respects the rights of its citizens, they have to grant the Arabs broader rights. But that means playing hell with their political integrity, which depends on soothing their own extreme religious elements. And that crowd doesn't care a rat's ass about Arab rights, does it? But if they cave in to the religious zealots and stonewall, try to gloss over this thing, then they are not a democracy, and that imperils the political support from America, without which they cannot survive economically or militarily. The same dilemma applies to us. Our support for Israel is based on their political legitimacy as a functioning liberal democracy, but that legitimacy just evaporated. A country whose police murder unarmed people has no legitimacy, Marcus. We can no more support an Israel that does things like this than we could have supported Somoza, Marcos, or any other tinpot dictator. God damn it, Charlie! Israel isn't...
I know that, Marcus. They're not. They're really not. But the only way they can prove that is to change, to become true to what they have always claimed to be. If they stonewall on this, Marcus, they're doomed. They'll lean on their political lobby and find out it isn't there anymore. If it goes that far, then they embarrass our government even more than it already is, and we'll be faced with the possible necessity of overtly cutting them off. We can't do that either. We must find another alternative.
Alden turned back from the window. Ryan, that idea of yours is now on the front burner. I'll handle the president and state. The only way we can get Israel out of this is to find some kind of a peace plan that works.
Call your friend at Georgetown and tell him it's no longer a study. Call it Project Pilgrimage. By tomorrow morning, I need a good sketch of what we want to do and how we want to do it.
That's awful fast, sir, Ryan observed. Then don't let me stop you, Jack. If we don't move quickly on this, God only knows what might happen. You know Scott Adler at State?
We've talked a few times.
He's Brent Talbot's best man. I suggest you get together with him after you check with your friends. He can cover your backside on the State Department flank. We can't trust that bureaucracy to do anything fast. Better pack some bags, boy. You're going to be busy. I want facts, positions, and a gold-plated evaluation just as fast as you can generate it, and I want it done black as a coal mine. That last remark was aimed at Cabot. If this is going to work, we can't risk a single leak.
Yes, sir. Ryan said.
Cabot just nodded.
Jack had never been in the faculty residence at Georgetown. It struck him as odd, but he shoved that thought aside as breakfast was served. Their table overlooked a parking lot.
You were right, Jack, Riley observed. That was nothing to wake up to.
What's the word from Rome?
They like it, the president of Georgetown University replied simply.
How much? Ryan asked.
You're serious?
Alden told me 2 hours ago that this is now on the front burner.
Riley accepted this news with a nod.
Trying to save Israel, Jack? Ryan didn't know how much humor was in the question, and his physical state did not allow levity. Father, all I'm doing is following up on something. You know, orders. I am familiar with the term. Your timing was pretty good on floating this thing. Maybe so, but let's save the Nobel Prize for some other time, okay? Finish your breakfast. We can still catch everybody over there before lunch. And you look pretty awful. I feel pretty awful, Ryan admitted. Everybody should stop drinking about 40, Riley observed. After 40, you really can't handle it anymore. You didn't, Jack noted. I'm a priest. I have to drink. What exactly are you looking for? If we can get preliminary agreement from the major players, we want to get negotiations going ASAP, but this end of the equation has to be done very quietly. The president needs a quick evaluation of his options. That's what I'm doing. Will Israel play? If they don't, they're fucked. Excuse me, but that's exactly where things are. You're right, of course. But will they have the sense to recognize their position? Father, all I do is gather and evaluate information. People keep asking me to tell fortunes, but I don't know how. What I do know is that what we saw on TV is going to ignite the biggest firestorm since Hiroshima, and we sure as hell have to try to do something before it burns up a whole region. Eat. I have to think for a few minutes, and I do that best when I'm chewing on something. It was good advice, Ryan knew a few minutes later. The food soaked up the coffee acid in his stomach, and the energy from the food would help him get through the day. Inside an hour, he was on the move again, this time to the State Department. By lunch, he was on his way home to pack, managing to nap for 3 hours along the way. He stopped back at Alden's White House office for a session that dragged far into the night. Alden had really taken charge there, and the skull session in his office covered a huge amount of ground. Before dawn, Jack headed off to Andrews Air Force Base. He was able to call his wife from the VIP lounge. Jack had hoped to take his son to a ball game over the weekend, but for him, there wouldn't be a weekend. A final courier arrived from CIA, State, and the White House, delivering 200 pages of data that he'd have to read on the way across the Atlantic. Chapter 4. Promised Land. The U.S. Air Force's Ramstein Air Base is set in a German valley, a fact which Ryan found slightly unsettling. His idea of a proper airport was one on land that was flat as far as the eye could see. He knew that it didn't make much of a difference, but it was one of the niceties of air travel to which he'd become accustomed. The base supported a full wing of F-16 fighter bombers, each of which was stored in its own bomb-proof shelter, which in its turn was surrounded by trees. The German people have a mania for green things that would impress the most ambitious American environmentalists. It was one of those remarkable cases in which the wishes of the tree-huggers coincided exactly with military necessity. Spotting the aircraft shelters from the air was extremely difficult, and some of the shelters, French-built, had trees planted on top of them, making camouflage both aesthetically and militarily pleasing. The base also housed a few large executive aircraft, including a converted 707 with the United States of America painted on it. Resembling a smaller version of the president's personal transport, it was known locally as Miss Piggy, and was assigned to the use of the commander of USAF units in Europe. Ryan could not help but smile. Here were over 70 fighter aircraft tasked to the destruction of Soviet forces which were now drawing back from Germany, housed on an environmentally admirable facility, which was also home to a plane called Miss Piggy. The world was truly mad. On the other hand, traveling Air Force guaranteed excellent hospitality and VIP treatment worthy of the name, in this case at an attractive edifice called the Cannon Hotel. The base commander, a full colonel, had met his VC-20B Gulfstream executive aircraft and whisked him off to his distinguished visitor's quarters, where a slide-out drawer contained a nice collection of liquor bottles to help him conquer jet lag with 9 hours of drink-augmented sleep. That was just as well, because the available television service included a single channel. By the time he awoke at about 6 in the morning local, he was almost in sync with the time zones, stiff and hungry, having almost survived another bout with travel shock. He hoped. Jack didn't feel like jogging. That was what he told himself. In fact, he knew that he couldn't have jogged half a mile with a gun to his head. And so he walked briskly. He soon found himself being passed by early morning exercise nuts, many of whom had to be fighter pilots, they were so young and lean. Morning mist hung in the trees that were planted nearly to the edge of the black-topped roads. It was much cooler than at home, with the still air disturbed every few minutes by the discordant roar of jet engines, the sound of freedom, the audible symbol of the military force that had guaranteed the peace of Europe for over 40 years, now resented by the Germans, of course. Attitudes change as rapidly as the times. American power had achieved its goal and was becoming a thing of the past, at least as far as Germany was concerned. The inner German border was gone. The fences and guard towers were down. The mines were gone. The plowed strip of dirt that had remained pristine for 2 generations to betray the footprints of defectors was now planted with grass and flowers. Locations in the east once examined in satellite photos, or about which Western intelligence agencies had sought information at the cost of both money and blood, were now walked over by camera-toting tourists, among whom were intelligence officers more shocked than bemused at the rapid changes that had come and gone like the sweep of a spring tide. I knew that I was right about this place, some thought. Or, how did we ever blow that one so badly? Ryan shook his head. It was more than amazing. The question of the 2 Germanys had been the centerpiece of East-West conflict since before his birth, had appeared to be the one unchanging thing in the world, the subject of enough white papers and special national intelligence estimates and news stories to fill the entire Pentagon with pulp. All the effort, all the examination of minutiae, the petty disputes, gone, soon to be forgotten. Even scholarly historians would never have the energy to look at all the data that had been thought important, crucial, vital, worthy of men's lives, and was now little more than a vast footnote to the end of the Second World War. This base had been one such item, designed to house the aircraft whose task it was to clear the skies of Russian planes and crush a Soviet attack. It was now an expensive anachronism whose residential apartments would soon house German families. Ryan wondered what they'd do with the aircraft shelters like that one there. Wine cellars, maybe. The wine was pretty good. Halt! Ryan stopped cold in his tracks and turned to see where the sound had come from. It was an Air Force security policeman. A woman. Girl, actually, Ryan saw, though her M16 rifle neither knew nor cared about plumbing fixtures. Did I do something wrong? ID, please. The young lady was quite attractive and quite professional. She also had a backup in the trees. Ryan handed over his CIA credentials. I've never seen one of these, sir. I came in last night on the VC-20. I'm staying over at the inn, room 109. You can check with Colonel Parker's office. We're on security alert, sir, she said next, reaching for her radio. Just do your job, miss. Excuse me, Sergeant Wilson. My plane doesn't leave till 10. Jack leaned against a tree to stretch. It was too nice a morning to get excited about anything, even if there were 2 armed people who didn't know who the hell he was. Roger. Sergeant Becky Wilson switched off her radio. The colonel's looking for you, sir. On the way back, I turn left at the Burger King? That's right, sir. She handed his ID back with a smile. Thanks, Sarge. Sorry to bother you. You want a ride back, sir? The colonel's waiting. I'd rather walk. He can wait. He's early. Ryan walked away from a buck sergeant who now had to ponder the importance of a man who kept her base commander sitting on the front step of the cannon. It took 10 brisk minutes, but Ryan's directional sense had not left him, despite the unfamiliar surroundings and a 6-hour time differential. Morning, sir, Ryan said as he vaulted the wall into the parking lot.
I set up a little breakfast with CommuSafe staff. We'd like your views on what's happening in Europe.
Jack laughed.
Great. I'm interested in hearing yours.
Ryan walked off toward his room to dress.
What makes them think I know anything more than they do? By the time his plane left, he'd learned 4 things he hadn't known.
Soviet forces withdrawing from what had formerly been called East Germany were decidedly unhappy with the fact that there was no place for them to withdraw to. Elements of the former East German army were even less happy about their enforced retirement than Washington actually knew. They probably had allies among ex-members of the already de-established Stasi. Finally, though an even dozen members of the Red Army faction had been apprehended in Eastern Germany, at least that many others had gotten the message and vanished before they too could be swept up by the Bundeskriminalamt, the German federal police. That explained the security alert at Ramstein, Ryan was told. The VC-20B lifted off from the airfield just after 10 in the morning, headed south. Those poor terrorists, he thought, devoting their lives and energy and intellect to something that was vanishing more swiftly than the German countryside below him. Like children whose mother had died. No friends now. They'd hidden out in Czechoslovakia and the German Democratic Republic, blissfully unaware of the coming demise of both communist states. Where would they hide now? Russia? No chance. Poland? That was a laugh. The world had changed under them, and was about to change again, Ryan thought with a wistful smile. Some more of their friends were about to watch the world change. Maybe, he corrected himself. Maybe.
Hello, Sergei Nikolaevich, Ryan had said as the man had entered his office a week before.
Ivan Emetovich, the Russian had replied, holding out his hand. Ryan remembered the last time they'd been this close, on the runway of Moscow's Sheremetyevo airport. Golovko had held a gun in his hand then. It had not been a good day for either, but as usual, it was funny the way things had worked out. Golovko, for having nearly but not quite prevented the greatest defection in Soviet history, was now first deputy chairman of the Committee for State Security. Had he succeeded, he would not have gone quite so far, but for being very good, if not quite good enough, he'd been noticed by his own president, and his career had taken a leap upward. His security officer had camped in Nancy's office with John Clark, as Ryan had led Golovko into his.
I am not impressed.
Golovko looked around disapprovingly at the painted gypsum board drywall. Ryan did have a single decent painting borrowed from a government warehouse, and, of course, the not exactly required photo of President Fowler over by the clothes tree on which Jack hung his coat.
I do have a nicer view, Sergei Nikolaevich. Tell me, is the statue of Iron Felix still in the middle of the square?
For the moment.
Golovko smiled.
Your director is out of town, I gather.
Yes, the president decided that he needed some advice.
On what?
Golovko asked with a crooked smile. Damned if I know, Ryan answered with a laugh. Lots of things, he didn't say.
Difficult, is it not?
For both of us. The new KGB chairman was not a professional spook either. In fact, that was not unusual. More often than not, the director of that grim agency had been a party man. But the party was becoming a thing of history also, and Narmanov had selected a computer expert who was supposed to bring new ideas into the Soviet Union's chief spy agency. That would make it more efficient. Ryan knew that Golovko had an IBM PC behind his desk in Moscow now.
Sergei, I always used to say that if the world made sense, I'd be out of a job. So look what's happening.
Want some coffee?
I would like that, Jack.
A moment later, he expressed approval of the brew.
Nancy sets it up for me every morning. So, what can I do for you? I have often heard that question, but never in such surroundings as this.
There was a rumbling laugh from Ryan's guest.
My God, Jack.
Do you ever wonder if this is all the result of some drug-induced dream?
Can't be. I cut myself shaving the other day, and I didn't wake up. Golovko muttered something in Russian that Jack didn't catch, though his translators would when they went over the tapes.
I am the one.